Thank you for downloading this New Zealand Sports Radio show. We have a new way that you can support us. There is a link in the notes down below where you can make a one-off donation to New Zealand Sports Radio. Thank you for support and enjoy the show.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello and welcome to another edition of The Long Talk. Today, we're going to be talking about an interesting one, a sport that doesn't want to be competitive by the looks of things, and one that, when I did a bit of research, did not come from where I thought it came from, which is an interesting one, because we are going to be talking about parkour, which is all about getting from A to B in either the most economical fashion or the most direct fashion, or in the most stylistic fashion, depending on which type of parkour you get involved in or free running. But again, we'll talk about the differences of that, because today I have the CEO of Parkour New Zealand, Dr. Damien Pudley. How are you doing, sir?
I'm good, thank you.
So we'll get into all of that stuff later, but life is a journey, as is parkour. Parkour is a journey from A to B. So let's start off with your journey. What's your first sporting memory, be it either playing or watching?
Of any kind.
Of any kind.
Wow. I think probably when I was about 6 or 7, I was in a dance class here in Hamilton, in New Zealand. And all I remember is the term step ball change. So if there's any dancers that watching this, they'll probably know what that is. I don't remember what it is anymore. But I did about a year of that and then quit because I had to play rugby because my friends played rugby. And yep. So most of my early sporting memories besides that sort of first introduction around dance are all about rugby.
That's interesting. Obviously, a lot of Kiwis, obviously you can talk about my accent, I'm English, but a lot of Kiwis, yeah, talk about, yes, the first time is running out playing, as you say, playing rugby, quite often in bare feet and quite often full contact at the age of about 5 or 6. or the other one is waking up at like 3 o'clock in the morning and sat in front of the TV with their parents watching All Blacks overseas games is another common one with a cup of Milo. Did your parents get you to do that as well?
My parents are not particularly sporty. They were more interested in theatre and things like that. So maybe that was why I sort of ended up gravitating towards dance initially. So I sort of bucked the trend in terms of my heavy involvement within the sporting landscape compared to the rest of my family. Although my grandfather was a very keen football player and cricketer and loved his rugby and things as well.
Interesting. There's going to be a few interesting steps, I think, on your journey looking at LinkedIn profile where you sort of jump around between things. But so did you ever play any sort of representative sports or did you continue rugby throughout your school career?
I never really played at a rep level. I think I tried out for a few things from memory, but I don't think I ever got into anything. I played locally for Taupiri in Hamilton or around Hamilton, and then but my family moved to Canada and lived in Toronto for 8 years, and so there I played for the Toronto Nomads, and but I started picking up a few injuries, and so I got swung around by a guy in a sort of a friendly match against our own within our own club against an older grade. The coaches thought that would be a fun idea to put the the sort of the under 14s against the under 16s in a bit of a friendly scrap, and some guy nicknamed Angry Terry swung me around by the jersey and I broke my collarbone. And then the following year after that, managed to break my jaw. And so that wasn't too flash, but moved back to New Zealand and I played for Hamilton Marist, and I had a concussion. And it was then that I realized, I'm about 75 kilos, 70 kilos, depending on where I'm at, and about 167 centimeters tall, and I'm still playing center. I'm not getting any bigger. And I've just had my first brain injury. I don't think I want another one. So I stopped playing rugby.
That's interesting because, parkour is not really a team sport. But it's interesting that you're playing team sports all the way through your upbringing and your school career, because I was expecting something maybe like a tennis or something like that to come into to be in your background, but no, you're team sports.
Yeah, I sort of dabbled in a few different things like that. Like I remember doing tennis part of tennis club at school when I was before moving to Canada, and I enjoyed that. I tried my hand at skateboarding because I had some friends that were keen skateboarders and surfers and things, but that didn't quite seem to suit me at the time, at least. And then moved to Canada, and besides that, maybe a little bit of roller hockey, a little bit of baseball, just sort of pick up games and friends in the park or in the cul-de-sac. And then back in New Zealand, a little bit of volleyball, social touch. For the last sort of 11, 12 years, it's almost been exclusively parkour.
You've tried your hand at quite a lot of things, which probably explains your role in Waikato Sport at the moment. Sport Waikato. Sorry, I was getting the wrong way around. But before that, a labourer. Was that sort of after school? Got involved in collodion daffodils, so it sounds like planting flowers.
Planting daffodils, yeah. I worked on a daffodil farm for a couple of years and I loved it. It was, it was outdoors in all weather. People say, you worked on a daffodil farm. So, well, they've got to come from somewhere. I really enjoyed it. It was just a varied job. It was, stuff was happening in all seasons and it was different every time. I did that while I was studying my undergrad at WinTech.
Ah, okay, so it was a part-time kind of thing. Flower farm. Oh, it's just flower arranging. It's all kind of. But no, you're digging trenches, driving tractors. very manual not the kind of image of flower arranging or flowers that you'd kind of think. So you did that during your undergraduate, and then you switched from being this is the jump thing I just couldn't see, from a labourer to being a director of a fitness company. How does that jump come about?
So my studies were in sport and exercise science at WinTech, and I really, really enjoyed studying there. And the flower farm, the daffodil farm, was owned by family friends, and so that connection was just an easy one in terms of being able to secure that job. And it was kind of flexible in terms of hours, which was helpful. And so it just fit around the studies. And following the degree, a close friend of mine, we had been doing a little bit of fitness work together, and so started this little company called Shape Living, and we were just doing personal training and group fitness instruction, and just finding ways to get people active in different kinds of ways, getting them outdoors rather than having to be stuck inside a gym. And so in terms of, I guess, doing physical work outdoors, that's, I guess, part of that part of that work.
Was this kind of a bit, because that's probably around about that sort of time. I remember being sort of in Singapore and Hong Kong. There were lots of kind of boot camp and sort of CrossFit with stretchy things done in parks and trying to get out of gym. So it was all part of that movement, was it?
Yes, quite similar to that.
And then you decided, actually, you know, this whole studying thing's a great idea, and also you like letters, so you decide to go back and and do some more study at the University of Waikato, but actually going down the teaching route, which is I guess a bit like personal training people teaching. There's a kind of crossover there.
Yeah, well, so it was my PhD that I did at the University of Waikato, and so I finished that last year, and I had always wanted to do further study after doing my third year of my undergraduate degree, and I had took a sort of a research paper, and I was like, this is when you get to do your own work, this is really cool. And I had gotten into parkour at the time, and I basically spun all my studies towards parkour, because I thought if I can study parkour, one, it's going to make my studies even more fun, but also it's going to potentially support the parkour community. And at the time, no one knew what it was at all, and it's still a little bit of an unknown in lots of places. And so I was really interested in further study, but I was doing it in biomechanics at the time. That was my honours year, was a biomechanics research and looking at the way parkour practitioners land when they're landing from jumps and from drops, and looking at these different landing forces that impact on their body and how do they cushion their falls and things like that. And I thought that was interesting, but I couldn't justify that being 3 years of my life on that project, but also how much impact is that going to have on the community? And so I wasn't so interested in it career-wise. I just thought it was how valuable could it be for the community. Didn't have an idea, and that's when the personal training and group fitness work was happening. But I was already quite involved with Parkour NZ, and so I got asked to participate in an interview by Professor Holly Thorpe at the University of Waikato, and she was doing some research on parkour, and so did that. And then from there, she invited me to attend a Sport NZ conference on a panel of different people involved in action sports broadly. So we had surfing and skating and a media representative. And through there, I met a colleague of hers who'd recently moved to New Zealand to pick up a position at the university, and they both sort of brainwashed me into doing a PhD in sociology of sport, which was a bit of a departure from the biomechanics. So I looked at the globalization of parkour from a New Zealand lens, and yeah, now I'm Dr. Puddle.
Well, yes, and you're one of the founding members, according to the New Zealand Parkour website, of the association there. Back in 2013. So when did you actually take up parkour?
So I started parkour in 2008, about August, roughly August 2008. So it's almost 12 years now.
So how did you stumble across parkour? How did you find out about it?
When I was living in Canada, I saw it on an ad on TV. It was Rogers, which is essentially Vodafone, but it was there was just a bunch of young people running around the city trying to find each other. And they end up on different buildings, and then they're laughing and they're like, oh, we should have used the phone and buy this phone, or, you know, this telephone company. But it didn't explain what it was. And so I had to do a lot of digging, and it took a while before I figured out what is the thing that they were doing called, but didn't know how to get involved. And so I just sort of left it. But after moving back to New Zealand, the first person I made friends with at WinTech was Hamilton, if not New Zealand's first practitioner. And so he invited me to come along, and I was quite nervous initially, and I had this opportunity and I wanted to take it, and then it was there and I sort of chickened out a little bit. So it took a few months, but then eventually I went along, and the rest is history.
That's interesting, because you mentioned parkour being there kind of part of the action sports, and you put it alongside skateboarding and surfing, which are both have kind of an anti-establishment culture to them. I always thought that the background of parkour was that it came out of basically estates in France, but generally social housing estates in France, and how people got around that. But having had a quick read up on it, parkour actually refers to the military piece of getting across an assault course, which was a bit of a surprise to me, that for a sport that from the outside the culture appears to be anti-establishment, it seems to have its roots in a very, well, in the military, in a very establishment kind of part of a society.
Yeah, I mean, it's quite an eclectic discipline. So the, yeah, as you say, it in terms of having a name put to it and having a culture, you know, developed around it, it did start in the sort of impoverished suburbs of France in Paris, and with these this group of young men who, yeah, if you read some of the a couple of the books and stuff that are out there on some of the history, talk about them having various influences on their life, including family in the military and in the fire service, as well as athletes, track runners and different things like that, influencing their practice, but also wanting to kind of escape gang life and stuff that was common amongst their peers. And so it ended up developing this practice of going around and taking some of this training of overcoming obstacles in a course format to just the, you know, the brutalist architecture and things that were around them, as well as the sort of the forests and other natural areas and things in their areas as well. But yeah, the term parkour itself is anglicized. So the original French word is spelt with a C and it has an S on the end, and that means route or course. So parkour du combattant is a course for combatants, which is the military obstacle course. So
yeah, it's interesting. And also I'm not claiming by any stretch to have read in depth, but this source, this concept that actually it's a martial art in some ways, a way of the whole idea of the assault course is to get from you to the enemy without getting shot at, basically. So in that way, it's a kind of martial art, sort of how you get from A to B without getting hit.
Running away.
But yeah, and that whole spiritual side of it was something that I was totally unaware of. It's not just
So it does have some sort of rich philosophical roots, and some of that's drawing on some Eastern philosophies and things, but also drawing on the ideologies and ideas of the early practitioners. So one of them is there's, I guess, philosophies that are inherent to the practice. So things like you can overcome obstacles, you know, that's the sort of, no one is holding that up on a flag as such necessarily, but that is obviously inherent to the pursuit of, we believe we can do it, and this is the outworking of it, is us actually going out and exploring these spaces. But there are some things that are shared around. One is called to be and to last, which is around, it depends on the person actually, but some people's interpretation are around sustainability. And so it's not a, the original practice was not an aesthetic practice. Any aesthetics were a byproduct of working hard, but it was wanting to be able to practice in a way that allowed you to keep doing the practice. And so it wasn't about, you know, I've done it for 3 years at the peak level and now I've retired. It's sort of this life pursuit, which ties it more in with martial arts in that respect. And then another piece is be strong to be useful. So again, as a activity that wasn't primarily meant to be aesthetic, it's not like bodybuilding, which is all about the aesthetic. It's a practice of, well, if you pick up and learn these skills and you get stronger and become more capable, what value can you bring, or what use are you, and how are you supporting those around you? So those are some of the ideas that underpinned it, sort of altruism and sustainability. But it's come a long way since then. So there's certainly some people who are not training particularly sustainably and are very much interested in the aesthetic.
But there is a competitive side, which I will get to afterwards, but also, yeah, because it's come through that that route of, you say, or originally of, A, the altruism, B, the giving you a pursuit that gets away from the gang piece. It is a bit like sort of mountain climbing in some ways. It's about pushing your body and about seeing what you can do and with the others, rather than what you against the elements, rather than necessarily you against someone else as to who can get through something. It's who doing quicker or harder. It's about you, getting through that course as a personal challenge more than a competitive challenge on the whole, isn't it?
Yes, that's right.
and also part of the lifestyle. As you say, it's a lifestyle thing. It's something that also, this was, if you don't do it regularly, I guess it's pretty tough to, it's not a pick up and put down sport either, because the conditioning you require.
Well, it depends, because, you know, you get to make the it's a challenge by choice activity. And so you get to choose what is an appropriate obstacle? Is it a tall building? Is it a tree? Is it a curb? So it's, you know, incredibly scalable. And you then also get to choose how you overcome it. Am I stepping onto the curb, or am I jumping onto the curb, or am I flipping onto the curb? And so all of that is customizable as well. And so, so I think you can pick it up and put it down. The challenge is where, you know, if you were training to a really high level, or, you know, just training regularly all the time, like we would go out and train for 4 hours at a stint, and just be walking around and exploring places. And, you know, there'd be lots of breaks in that time period, but easily my training sessions when I was studying would be, you know, 2 to 6 hour training sessions. And yeah, got very strong and very fit and very capable in ways that I hadn't been previously through my other sporting experiences. And now I have a family, I have a full-time job, and in my extra hours I'm trying to support the administration work of Parkour NZ and Parkour Earth, so I have a bit less time to actually go out there and train. And so sometimes when I step out there, it's like, I know what I used to be able to do, and I would like to be able to do that, but is that sensible for me to try right now? Should I at the very least warm up? Or yeah, so it definitely goes through ebbs and flows, but I do think you can pick it up and put it down, so long as you're being sensible about what you choose to do.
Yeah, that sensible thing is a big thing. I used to be a very good skier, up till basically while school, and when I left, went to university and suddenly I wasn't doing sort of 4 weeks at Christmas and 4 weeks at Easter in Europe skiing. I was just doing 1 week on holiday, and suddenly put myself at the top of one slope, threw myself down it knowing I could, well, thinking I could always do, I could ski this easily. Two turns in, realised I'm out of control, my body's not doing what I'm telling it to do, and I survived that run.
Yeah.
I must admit, I then took off those skis. I skied down, took off those skis, and I've never put skis on again. I now snowboard, purely because now my head, what my body can do and what my head thinks I can do are matched, whereas with skis they're a million miles apart. So yeah, so you say you have to be a bit careful. Yeah. Falling down
you can definitely, like, if you search up some groups, you know, there are people who they devote themselves to this, you know, they are like the All Blacks of parkour, who are immensely capable, have learned to, you know, get their bodies to do amazing things, and they know themselves so well. But you can, just like people go for a run, you know, you can train to do a marathon, or you can become a sprinter and you can do these things really fast or for a long time, or turn it into more of an obstacle course race, you know, these big long endurance events and different things like that. But you can also just go out for a jog. And so in the same way, doing parkour doesn't mean you have to be going from building to building or with any great speed, or, you know, the intent is up to you. So it can be explored fairly casually. One of the challenges for the community is what messaging is put forward, because certainly the things that people would say are extreme or adrenaline fueled are the things that get the clicks, and so that's often the stuff that gets shared, more so than, you know, the fact that there's, you know, activities and classes and groups that work specifically with pensioners. So you have the elderly doing parkour, it just doesn't look the same as, you know, what an 18-year-old's training might look like.
Okay, so it is it's a very accessible sport then, and it sounds more like a lifestyle rather than a sport, in some ways, a bit like some people suggest that CrossFit has become a lifestyle rather than actually a sport nowadays.
Yeah, sure, I can see that parallel. And I think, yeah, inclusive in theory, because I do think that the culture and what media and different things, you know, perpetuate a specific image. Mm-hmm. So, you know, when I started, there was no particular, you know, body type, I guess, associated with parkour. There was no sort of, yes, there were the founders, and they had a particular way of moving, and they did look athletic and strong. But most of the other people, you know, YouTube was invented in 2005. One of the early documentaries, Jump London, was in 03, and a follow-up one in 04. And so I came onto the scene in 2008, about 3 or 4 years later, when it was sort of starting to boom around the world. And people just had these, you know, bad quality little cameras and just filming themselves, trying different things. And that everyone was pretty uncoordinated, but just excited about going out and being creative and trying this new thing that they'd heard about. And, you know, a lot of people refer to themselves as, you know, they were nerds before they got into parkour. Like my friend who got me into parkour, he was into things like wakeboarding and snowboarding, but he hated team sports. And he has a story about himself falling asleep playing cricket when he was a kid on the field, but just, you know, hated all that sort of stuff. And so you had a group of sort of misfits and people who got picked last for the team and all that kind of stuff and got into this practice. But now, 10, 15 years later, they're strong, fit, lean, capable people with this vision of, oh, parkour is super inclusive, anyone can do it because this is my story and this is my history. But now everyone looking at the parkour community now, it's all of these people who have worked so hard and you may not know their histories and their stories, and so it looks less accessible because it looks very athletic that you need to look like this and look like that. So the challenge for the community and for the organizations and the clubs and the people running classes and things like that is to say, actually, it can be like this, and this is what it used to be like, and, you know, don't be put off by the amazing stuff.
Yeah, I guess, I guess one of the other differences is something like surfing. You have there are certain size waves that, as a beginner, you would go nowhere near, and if you watch competitive surfing, you wouldn't want to be surfing in those waters; you'd be dangerous. But I guess that's a kind of natural thing, as you can see. Okay, I can do a small wave, and that's a big wave, whereas. Mm. You see someone going up the outside of the stairwell, on an outside apartment block, and you go, well, I can't imagine a small one of those. There isn't the same kind of graduation, even. But yeah, as you say, the small one of those is actually a curb on the that you can also practice on as well. One of the things I sort of touched on the intro was that it's about getting from A to B quickly, and we talked about that we've sort of mentioned that on the foundations of how one of the routes into this has been via the assault course. But there is also an aesthetic side to it, which I think is what people refer to more as free running, rather than, and I guess what's the difference in parkour and free running? Are they really different, or are they just two versions of the same sport?
Yeah, it depends on who you talk to. So a lot of people, particularly now, use the term parkour to just mean everything within the practice, whatever it looks like. Mm-hmm. Some people would differentiate between, as you say, parkour being a little bit more utilitarian, or, you know, type movement skills that are a bit more practical, and free running be a bit more expressive and acrobatic. And then you'd also get people who train what people might say is parkour, and it's, you know, it's the practical movement skills, but they're used to calling themselves a free runner because that got more popular within the UK, for example. And then there'd be people who say they're doing parkour and it is very acrobatic. So it makes things a little bit messy at times. So we use the term parkour to mean everything. But, on the Parkour NZ website, we do sort of say that free running can be tied with the more acrobatic expression of the practice.
Right, okay. And as so you've been on, had an association here in New Zealand for nearly 8 years now. You're recognised, I assume, by New Zealand Sport?
So I took over the role in around 2013, but actually incorporated in 2011. Okay. And we do not have an investment relationship with Sport NZ, but we're in regular conversation with them, and they know who we are. And parkour is listed on the Sport NZ website, and it comes through to us. But we're not yet, in their
top
40 or top 50 or whatever funded sports.
Now, I did have a chat with New Zealand Sport, and they said, look, there are 75 sporting associations in New Zealand. So I guess you're one of those, but not one of the not one of the funded ones. And so how have you grown over the past, 10 years, pretty much, or 11 years.
Yeah, well, it started out, people connected via online message boards, forums, and so that was sort of the first collective thing besides the forum that the community did, was recognize, you know, we see great value in our practice and we're learning all this wonderful stuff and it's teaching us so much about ourselves and about our world, but everyone thinks we're just jumping off buildings. You know, if we formed an association of some kind, would that be perceived as more legitimate, because that's what you know, everyone else is used to seeing within the sporting landscape in New Zealand? So that's what we did. Formed New Zealand Parkour Association, short form as Parkour NZ or Te Hōkai Aotearoa. So we were started in Wellington, my signature's on those founding documents, but it wasn't really my brainchild. I was just part of those early conversations. And then because I was getting so excited and so interested in it, and some changes in what was happening in some of the original people's lives, I ended up taking over the leadership role in around 2013. And so it's based in Hamilton ever since, just because of my involvement. But yeah, we went from, it was just a bit of a website, and then we started running our own classes, and so we were both the national body, but also a deliverer, you know, most rather than purely an administrative body, also doing delivery, and that model remains at this stage, but most of our classes are based in the Waikato and out of Hamilton. We do a range of different things. We have events and things around the country.
So how many members are you up to now?
That's always a hard one. So we have a membership base around, you know, 50 odd practitioners and stuff that are, you know, that pay a fee and sort of invest into supporting the organisation. But, you know, there'd be, you know, a couple of hundred practitioners around the country that sort of parkour is their main thing. And then there'd be, you know, 10,000 or more people having a parkour experience throughout the year. They're really hard to gauge, because, you know, if you decided, actually, I might have a little go, you know, next time you go for a walk, I might climb over that bench there, or, you know, try something like that. And so it's hard to gauge that, you know. Athletics will know how many people they have that run certain distances because of their registrations, but, you know, you have to look at the Sport NZ data to try and get an understanding of how many people just go for a run. And so parkour is starting to get added to those pieces, those surveys and things like that, to gauge a better understanding of what the practice looks like. But I think it'll always be a little bit difficult, because it is, the practice is spanning from people who are participating it as their core activity, as their sport, to people just doing it very casually. You know, it feels and looks like children's play. That's hard to quantify.
Do you also, we've said it's mainly a lifestyle rather than a competitive sport, but there is a competitive side to it as well. And so do you run and host competitions?
Yeah, it is now. So traditionally, it is non-competitive, it would be interesting to know what it would be like if, you know, certain people, figureheads or different people hadn't gotten involved and pushed it in that direction. Humans are naturally competitive, they have created a number of different formats around the world to try and, I guess, in some ways, kind of monetize parkour and create a format that is competitive as a different kind of event. And so they traditionally follow, well, so far, it's still continues, you know, it's a very young activity, so it continues to evolve. But those competitive formats tend to follow three different areas. One is essentially a speed, you know, short form obstacle course type race, and that's lasting anywhere from 10 to 30 seconds sort of time frame, maybe a minute at the largest type of course, and then also an acrobatic, more acrobatic expressive sort of thing, where maybe they have access to a certain part of the course and they have to choreograph a performance of some kind within a certain time limit, and that is judged. on a few different pieces of criteria, and then an one that's sort of in between those two in terms of purely a speed element, in terms of it's easy to quantify, you got this fast or you didn't, and a completely subjective judging piece, and that's what they call a skill. And so those are predefined challenges that people have to try and complete in and maybe the less amount number of attempts, or do it the cleanest. And so those are sort of the three that are most typically being explored at the moment. And so, yeah, we run every year up in Auckland at Flow Academy of Motion, an indoor training facility there. And it's called JAMZAC, because we call our events JAMS, and we hosted it around Anzac weekend. So JAMZAC.
Oh, okay. And that equates to basically being the national championships, I guess, as well, from that point of view. So interestingly, yeah, three different disciplines there, I guess the middle one, which you say, where people choreograph something, is it done to music, or do you do it, or is it just purely choreographed within that space?
I don't think I've seen any that have been explicitly choreographed to music. There's often they might pick a song and have a song playing during their run,
right.
But that's usually just to help make them feel comfortable in what they're choosing to do.
Okay, so it's not got like figure skating where you have those, I mean, at the Olympics you have two different types of figure skating, one which has got lots of jumps and the other one which is kind of expressive to the music, kind of thing. It's not got to that kind of level where it's not gone in that direction to be kind of when it goes bang is when you're supposed to land and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, not yet. Although there are, you know, parkour is being included in performance aspects, so not in a competitive style, but more in a theatrical and performance ways. And so in that aspect, there is things that are being done to music. But yeah, not in that competitive style way like figure skating.
Cool. Now, and as you say, you, there is an indoor facility up in Auckland. I believe there's one here in Hamilton as well. Can you, for those people who haven't seen one, can you describe what does an indoor parkour facility look like?
Well, they all look quite different, actually, which is good, I think, is a good thing. But I guess imagine a cityscape, a miniature cityscape of walls and bars and boxes and things like that, but typically made out of plywood. Within an indoor facility. So they're often, in New Zealand at least, there's no purely parkour facilities. They're all multi-use facilities that incorporate other things. So the one in Hamilton, for example, adjoins, was owned by the same group that owned a mixed martial arts facility called Kori Mime. And so the parkour side of the gym also has a foam pit and a sprung floor for tricking, which is basically flat land acrobatics, as well as things like tumbling and cheerleading and more gymnastic skills and things like that. So there's often a range of these different things. Some, you know, Flo has some trampoline tracks into their foam pit space. I always find this funny, but Flo has a warped wall from Ninja Warrior. So even though there's no Ninja Warrior in New Zealand, I think that wall in, even in Kiwis' heads, they've seen Ninja Warrior Australia or UK or the USA, and they're, oh, I've seen that wall. I know that wall. I'd like to try if I could, you know, see if I could get up. So both their gyms have a warped wall in it. But yeah, Flo's obstacles are basically just bare plywood. So it's just a brown sort of color, and they have these big, big blocks that can actually be flipped on their sides and shifted around, and so heavy that they don't move anywhere, but they can sort of basically change what the gym looks like from time to time. Whereas the Hamilton one has a sort of a samurai and Dragon Ball Z themed graffiti art and stuff all over it to create quite a different aesthetic, and it's more fixed obstacles but with a lot of movable smaller pieces as well. So it varies from place to place. And I recently actually saw a gym in Belgium that I hadn't seen before, which a lot of it is basically steel bars, so lots and lots of swinging and different kinds of movements like that, but actually a lot of brickwork. So it's less, is actually made of plywood, and it's actually more replicating the outdoors.
That's interesting, because the bar thing sounds pretty similar to the professional tag competitions that I've seen on YouTube, which basically look like your basic pieces of scaffolding with the occasional platform here and there. Which is
Lots of scaffolding. We'd get in trouble if we called it scaffolding, because then you're supposed to have railings and, you know, do, you know, height stuff and all that kind of stuff. So it's we usually go one size down from a typical scaffolding size pipe, but yeah, that steel pipe.
That kind of thing. And I guess the other way of looking at it is, if you've seen a skate park, take a skate park and anything that's sort of slopey, make it blocky, and that's pretty much what a parkour park looks sort of kind of a bit similar to. Is how I kind of from the photos that I've seen, it's kind of what it kind of looks like, for those of you who've not seen, to try and describe it audioly, as it were, in words. So I guess it's now becoming an all year round sport. I'm assuming it was a bit of a summer sport, that doing it in the rain wouldn't be such a fun thing to do, and also be a bit more dangerous. But I guess by having these indoor facilities, it becomes an all year round, daytime, nighttime kind of sport now.
It varies from community to community. So we, you know, for example, in countries that get a lot of snow, they naturally gravitate indoors already. And so a lot of them have a lot more indoor gyms and things like that. Whereas, you know, other places around the equator and areas like that are just training all the time. And in New Zealand, you can pretty much train all year round. And so for us, the community, the gyms provide an alternative way of training. And certainly if it is wet or it is cold, you can go into those spaces and use those spaces, or know that it's always consistent. You know, you'll always be able to have access to it. Whereas, you know, when you're outdoors and you're training just on the obstacles and things that you find, sometimes it's blocked off with a fence because they're doing some construction, or something's being painted, or things have been renovated, or they've cut your favourite tree down, or, you know, so it's always changing, so you're never quite sure whether what's going to be there. But rain is, in some ways, just another obstacle. Yeah, you probably can't move in exactly the same way, but you can still adapt to it and continue to move. So, yeah, our outdoor classes that we run in Hamilton, for example, we've never cancelled due to weather. So, we're on all the time.
There was me about to say, look, the indoor one makes it more accessible to, or the kind of the intro way to it, because it is, as you say, a controlled environment. It's all, but it sounds like, you're doing classes inside, outside, all over the place anyway. So, no, that's not necessarily the way, and that might not appeal to certain people.
For some people, it probably is a bit more palatable when they see it indoors. It's sort of, it's a bit, they might be a bit more used to that kind of environment, being in an indoor type space, and they might feel a bit more comfortable to try. But the whole practice is about understanding yourself and overcoming the obstacles. So it's you know, training indoors isn't necessarily a pathway to train outdoors. You don't have to start inside in order to do it outside. Everybody started outside originally. And actually, if you only ever train outside, when you go indoors, sometimes you can, there's a lot that you have to learn as well. And so it's, they're not identical. So it takes a bit of exploration to understand both.
You could say everyone started outside originally, but originally they started running away from gangs as well. I'm not sure we all want to do that bit of the, or recreate that part of it either.
You need to.
Over in France. Now, we've talked about facilities in Auckland and Hamilton. I see those links on your website. Is it something that is, you have practice, you know, of sort of groups down in Wellington? I mean, obviously, you mentioned Wellington's where Park, New Zealand Parkour actually was founded. So I'm guessing there's still happens there, and also a presence in the South Island?
So there's you know, groups from Whangarei, you know, down to Invercargill. So there's communities training in pretty much most major cities in around the country. I think some areas of the East Coast, sort of Gisborne, Hawke's Bay, those areas, there never has seemed to be a large community in some of those places. Auckland, Wellington, Christchurch, Dunedin, even Nelson, Invercargill, all have groups. but it can be a bit transient, particularly if it's young people that are picking things up and they get really excited, and you know, during high school, and there's a whole bunch of them, and then all of a sudden they go off to university, and so what used to have this tight bubble or group of practitioners in one city, all of a sudden they've spread out and gone this place and that place, and so we seem to get these, except for those that are starting to have the indoor gyms or things like that, the community seems to ebb and flow a bit more, and so yeah, but there are a couple of indoor gyms as well in the South Island, one in Christchurch or two in Christchurch and one in Queenstown.
Okay, so it's one of these things. I guess. So in some communities you're waiting, you still haven't quite got to critical mass. In others it has done so. Yeah, in others it's much more permanent permanent crowd. Two other things I just want to touch on before we finish, but you talk there about sort of it can just be jumping over a bench, or various places can be sort of closed off, and we've seen signposts go up in some areas saying no skateboarding here. And that point of view, how is that relationship with the authorities as to do they like you to see you clambering over a bench, or is it seen as a bit of a kind of hooligan behaviour?
Yeah, it's a bit of both. So you know, primarily people are sticking to public areas and public spaces, parks and infrastructure and stuff that's predominantly at ground level and accessible to anybody. But people's interest in pushing themselves and testing themselves and finding interesting architecture does sometimes mean that they end up trespassing and moving onto private property, or maybe the public areas, but scaling higher to find other, you know, features and things like that. And so, yeah, some people do find themselves having to have conversations with security or property owners, sometimes police, but it's mostly security. You know, in the US, they're always having to deal with police, for example, but in New Zealand, it's more the security companies that employed by the building owners where you have most of your conversations. And some of them know exactly what you're doing, and they might actually really like it, and they think, oh, this is, this is really cool, and I could watch you guys for hours, but I'm going to have to ask you to move on just because, you know, we are liable if you hurt yourselves on the property, so things like that. So that's a constant frustration for the community when they want to have personal ownership of their own mistakes. Mm-hmm. You know, they have no interest in pursuing, you know, I mean, we have ACC in New Zealand anyway, but, you know, they have no interest in pursuing litigation of, you know, these places. They know that they're doing parkour and none of these places were built for parkour. And so they do get annoyed at that, but rightly so, they are not on their own property. So, you know, they have every right to be moved on by the people who own those spaces. So, some communities, you know, the focus for them is train. If they get moved on, they'll leave. And every now and again, someone might get into an argument, but most people just say, cool, yep, absolutely. Is it okay if I just get one last video or, you know, something like that, and then we'll shoot off. So most groups are like that. In Hamilton, we did that, but we also made a real effort to actually communicate and talk about the practice such that, obviously I did my PhD at the University of Waikato, but we run our classes there. So there's constantly a training presence at the university on the grounds that there's no problem, so long as we don't climb up on the rooftops, and there's endless obstacles all over the campus. So we're there all the time. And so we get other parts of the country and us trying to work with the other university campuses to say, you know, you can actually embrace this activity in a holistic way that's going to actually support the growth of the university itself and the life of the university, rather than just looking at it purely from a sort of a fear and health and safety point of view.
And you said in there that it wasn't made for parkour, but in some ways everything that's been built is made for parkour. That's part of the idea.
Yeah,
isn't it?
Oh, yeah. I mean,
the flip side.
The ladder, is it not?
But yeah, you're right. The way we connected on LinkedIn was around public access and use of facilities. And look, if you're not damaging the facility, why not use it in another way that can be used by the public? It's makes a lot of sense.
The economic value of those spaces, you know, we do have, you know, New Zealand's first outdoor parkour park is at the Hamilton Lake Rotoroa, and which we helped design. And, you know, it's great to have that as a facility, but, you know, we talked more and more with the Hamilton City Council, don't go and say, oh, well, we'll build you your park, stay in the park. So that's not what the practice is about. This is cool. This is a cool way to celebrate it, create some architecture, create something totally unique and have a bit of a focal point down at the lake. Great space, great idea. But the practice is about exploring all these other spaces. And so if you don't have to build a park and you can just enable people to use these existing spaces, then it absolutely increases their value without having to spend any money.
Perhaps an extra thing is architects, if you want to know how you could add a little bit of parkour into your buildings, I'm sure you'd be happy to provide advice on that one. So all architects listening.
Yeah, we want people, you know, things get torn down because it's maybe ugly, older, I would say ugly, you know, brutalist type architecture, but some of that stuff is actually built to last, and all the new handrails and things getting put up are like, you know, very cheap metals, and it's like, oh, we can't use that because we're going to break it, so we have to go somewhere else. So please build strong things.
And the other thing is, you touched on it earlier about parkour earth, and I guess this astounds me that basically until last year there wasn't a global association of parkour, and you've put that together with some other countries last year for the first time. Is that right?
Almost, yeah. So 2017 we got formed, and I took over the CEO role last year, in August last year. So there has been multiple attempts, even from as early as about 2004 maybe, to set up an international body for parkour, but it was always kind of independent or kind of unilateral to the community. It was, you know, it was this group in this country thinks it's a good idea, so they've started it and they're asking everyone else to join them and support their idea, which different groups found it difficult to engage with that. And so this is the first, true international federation, in the sense that we had six national federations come together and say, we want this, we need this, let's build it from the ground up in a sort of a grassroots democratic way, and create something like that. So,
and an interesting combination of countries as well. So you've obviously New Zealand, and you've got some France, England, and Poland was a bit of a surprise. The parkour was a big Polish thing.
Yep. So the Polish organisation is there, South Africa, France, Switzerland, UK, Finland. We've also got the USA in there, joined recently, and in ongoing conversations with federations around the world that are just getting formulated units. Because parkour is only just entering into some countries, let alone being able to formalise something more organised, like a national body. But there are national bodies in Israel, Japan, Singapore, Indonesia, Malaysia, a number of other European countries as well, Croatia, Czechia. So they are all over the place, and it's just around people, you know, connecting and communicating with each other and starting to learn. And at the moment we're actually just going through a global engagement process to hear from all the federations, whether they're affiliated or not, and hearing from the grassroots practitioners as well as the influencers and the content creators within the media spaces around parkour, and hearing, you know, what could an international federation look like, both to really support parkour in the best way, but also what does a contemporary international sport federation look like? You know, when you're seeing all this, you know, we shouldn't need to have all of the athlete activism around the world, because we should have international and national federations that actually support their athletes and their community. Do we want to be corrupt or not corrupt? You know, what shoes do we want to follow?
You've got to have money first before you can get corrupt, really, surely.
We haven't got any of that, so we're safe for now.
Now, you are very right that it's when you end up with a professional sport, you end up with competing priorities. You have the obviously there's the actual people who do it, and then there's people who watch it, and then there's people who are looking to make money out of it or to gain out of it. And so, yeah, who actually owns, as in inverted commas, that sport, and who should it be designed for, as well? So, yeah, that's definitely a conflict that we see, well, in rugby for one, but in many sports, and even in the IOC, which is supposed to be the sort of amateur, which has supposed to have its whole ethos in the based in amateurism, but so there you go. Thank you so much. Is there anything I've not touched on from a PowerCorp point of view that you'd like to highlight?
Oh wow! I mean, I could talk PowerCorp forever, and just did so with one of these global engagement sessions for 2 hours this morning. But yeah, I guess that we think it has a great value. It is something that you can participate, in these range of different ways for these range of different motivations. Anyone can just go out and start looking at the world a little bit differently. And I think maybe that's something that I'd be interested in just highlighting, is that it starts, the things that I think about and I'm involved in now, a lot of that has come through the practice of PowerCorp, because it's shown me a different way of using the world, of interacting, being creative with the world. The work I'm doing with Sport Waikato has definitely been shaped by my parkour experiences, and how do you make something more inclusive? Look at these parkour people who are being creative and using something in a different way. Why can't other things be done like that? When we're building anything, are we thinking about it only for the person who's paying for it? Who else is going to benefit or be enabled or disabled by this space being there? And so, I think it really does change the way you see the world, and I can't turn it off anymore. I'm always looking around the place and my parkour eyes, my parkour vision, thinking about how I can get from there to there and do that thing. So at least once, I think people should just go have a try, see if it changes the way you see the world.
Well, perhaps on you need to have sort of add in a fun competition as to who can get from the sort of supermarket to the car park with a plastic bag full of shopping, and add it as a fun, silly element. A bit like have a crazy golf kind of style, crazy parkour, where you've got to not spill the milk between A and B, or whatever, or don't break any eggs. Anyway, thank you. It's been fascinating chatting and learning about parkour. As I say, it's not the sport that I thought it was yesterday. With the research that I've put into it, that whole it being a lifestyle and the and kind of a non-contact martial arts kind of approach is something that I was totally unaware of, and as you say, that whole looking at the world in a different way, the sustainability side of it as well is all pieces that I don't think people are aware of. So thank you for bringing that to light for us.
You're most welcome. Thanks for inviting me on.
It's been an absolute pleasure. Thank everyone who's watched. And please do subscribe to our Facebook page, New Zealand Sports Radio. You can also listen to us on the move. Just download New Zealand Sports Radio at on iTunes, Spotify, iHeartRadio, or your favourite podcatcher. And you'll find that Parkour NZ or Parkour New Zealand are also on Twitter, Facebook, all of those sort of places. So if you're interested in giving it a go, you can find them on all your socials, and they also have a website as well with links to various clubs and other and indoor facilities if you want to do it in the warm and dry, which is how I would personally do it, I'll be honest. Thank you all, and catch you all next time.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.